acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 60, Another Door Opens. Sunday, November 16th, 2014. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Yin Hu Cha Yuan, Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode can be found on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode features the following segments: the front porch, the back porch, ever-expanding skill set, a little bit of learning, and gratitude journal. Hello, everyone. I hope you have had a great week and a very nice weekend. The weather has turned decidedly chilly here in the Delaware Water Gap, and on Thursday evening, we made our first use of the snowlight. When we made renovations to the porch of Yin Hu a few years ago, Samuel decided that it would be a great idea to add an outlet for our laptop computers outside. When he did that, he asked the electrician to put in a spotlight that shines into our beautiful woods. And this is nice for observing the snowfall. There are a few evergreen trees right behind the house, and it creates a nice backdrop for any snowfall. So on Thursday afternoon, the weather turned extremely chilly, and when I walked out of work, I noticed that even though there was no precipitation, it felt like snow. And by nightfall, there was a mix of snow and rain falling here. So it was nice to snuggle up and watch that falling. And then in the morning, there wasn't any accumulating snowfall right where I live. But on my drive to work, going east on Route 80 through New Jersey, there are some higher elevations for the highway. And everything was coated in this sparkling white snow. It was so beautiful. A little early in the season to see that, but it was just beautiful. The sun was coming up and was lighting everything, so the woods were just dazzling. There was accumulated snow in Morris County where I work, and even at the end of the day, there was still some snow on the ground, and cars still had snow on them, so it stayed pretty cold. All of this colder weather and the snowfall has made me want to do more and more and more baking, which is perfect for the Bulk Bins cook-along, taking on flour in the month of November, and I will be talking about that a little more later in the show. Just before starting this recording, I checked the Ravelry boards, and there was a new introduction on the Yarns at Yin Hu Ravelry group. Welcome to Carmen from Nevada. I'm going to take a chance on your Ravelry name. I think it's Knit Trick to Scribble. We'll see how close I am about that. Thank you for introducing yourself, and welcome to the group. The front porch. I have begun and have made pretty good progress on a new project called the MPG, or multi-purpose garment. This is a pattern by Emily Estrada of the Fibertown podcast. It's for a hooded cape or hooded cowl, depending on the gauge and the type of yarn that you use. Emily created this pattern with her hand-spun yarn, and I am also using hand-spun to knit it. One of my objectives is to knit rather quickly with my hand-spun yarn, and this is just lovely yarn. This is a recent spin from fiber from Patrizia of BZB Fibers. It's a BFL or Blue Faced Lester silk blend in the papaya colorway. Lovely peachy pinks and greens. I spun this in a 2-ply and it's somewhere between fingering and DK. It's not a very consistent spin. It has some lumps and bumps and nubby parts, but it's a lot of fun to knit with, and I really am enjoying working on this little garment. There's a combination of garter and stockinette. I'm using size 6, US size 6 needles, and I'm on the short row portion of the little wimple or hood, and nearly done with the project. So that's been a lot of fun. Again, it's MPG or multi-purpose garment, pattern designed by Emily Estrada. I am also nearly finished with a new spin. This is some 100% Polworth, also dyed by Patrizia of BZB Fibers in the aubergine colorway. This begins as a creamy white, moves into some yellows, some greens with some pops of teal, an almost fuchsia, a more muted wine color, and then a very deep reddish brown. I split the braid of fiber and spun each half rather thin on my Louette, and now I am working on plying those together to preserve the color transitions so that I'll have a gradient yarn to work with and hopefully a great deal of yardage. I haven't thought about a project for this yarn, but I'm very eager to see what I come up with in terms of yardage and see how those color transitions come out in the finished yarn. The back porch. Over the past few weeks, I have completed 2 shawl projects that I'd like to talk a bit about on today's episode. This is an exciting development for me because I have created and published my first shawl pattern on Ravelry. This is an idea that began about a year ago. I take a walk almost every day, and very frequently the place where I walk is around the Shawnee Inn and Resort and Shawnee Village. There are a number of very mature and beautiful trees there. One of my favorites is a full and gorgeous ginkgo tree. I'm fascinated by it every year, and in particular in the fall. Today, when I walked by this tree, almost every leaf was on the ground because I think that cold snap of weather we had just convinced all of the leaves that they needed to leave the tree. And unlike other trees that shed their leaves and the leaves become browned and crunchy and crackly, the ginkgo leaf carpet is almost fabric-like. The leaves are golden yellow, and they stay very pliable and soft. They don't really blow around. They're quite heavy. And they just form this lovely carpet beneath the tree. I'm fascinated with the way the leaves change color on the tree. It starts at the tips of the branches, and then the yellow creeps to the inside branches of the tree. And then if you look at each leaf starts to change color very gradually. The outer edge is yellow, but near where the leaf attaches to the tree, it will still be green. So there's this whole ombre look to the ginkgo tree as it makes its change in autumn. I'm fascinated too by the shape of the ginkgo leaf. It has these gently sloping shoulders and a really nice, almost like a scalloped edge. It's a lot softer and more gentle than other kinds of leaves. I began thinking about a shawl design that would incorporate the shape of that ginkgo leaf into the design in maybe more of an abstract than a literal kind of way. One of my goals for myself this summer was to draft a pattern and knit up a shawl with this design in mind. I started to do that. I had the yarn. I started to knit the shawl and write down every move I made as I worked on it. And I just grew frustrated with the process. Things weren't working out the way I imagined. And I was very sorry to do it, but I put the project aside at the end of the summer. And I thought, well, that was my chance because in the summer I have more time to devote to a steep learning curve than I do during the rest of the year. So I thought that was it, and maybe I would revisit the notion again next summer. But then I completed the spindle spinning of this beautiful Polwarth silk fiber from Three Waters Farm in the rooftop colorway. I plied it together and I skeined up the yarn, and I could not stop thinking about what I could do with that yarn. It was just calling to me. I purchased and printed a number of patterns on Ravelry and didn't cast them on because none of them seemed quite right. And I realized one day as I was walking by the ginkgo tree in Shawnee Village that I needed to try again with my idea for the shawl pattern, and that maybe this beautiful yarn that I created would motivate me to complete the design. And it did. So I worked on writing the pattern as I knit it and was very pleased with the result. But then I wanted to make sure that the pattern worked and that it would also turn out well in a commercially available yarn. So I made an order. I made two orders, actually, and I promised myself that I would begin knitting with the first yarn that arrived, and that was some Quince and Company yarn in the Turn base, which is a wool silk blend, and I used the Dusk colorway. This yarn is a 3-ply, and it's incredibly round. And so I used a bit more of the yarn than I anticipated, and so I added a border in Claudia Handpaint's yarn. It's a fingering weight yarn in the Cabin Fever colorway. And I was pretty excited about adding a border with a different kind of yarn because some of the specks of color in this Claudia Handpaint's were the exact color of this dusky Quince and Company yarn. So I thought it was a really nice compliment. And the border of the shawl being knit in a different color sort of accentuated some of the elements of the pattern. So I was very pleased about that. I spent a lot of time thinking about how to convey the pattern to other knitters, and I'm very pleased with the table format that I used for this shawl design. Every row is written with stitch counts, and also there are percentages in the pattern. The shawl design is called Another Door Opens, and it's a reference to the changing seasons. I always feel very wistful and very reluctant to let go of the beautiful, sunny, warm days of October. Sometimes a day can be so beautiful that there's almost a pang of pain that I feel, because I know that it's something that won't last and it's so beautiful you can't hang on to it. But I came across a quote from Alexander Graham Bell to the effect of, you know, when one door closes, another door opens, and we shouldn't stand lingering in front of the closed door and not consider what the open door has in store for us. So I thought that was a fitting sentiment for this time of year and just for general aspect of change in our lives, and a reminder that we should look forward to what is coming. So I'm calling the shawl design Another Door Opens. It is knit with between 440 and 480 yards of fingering weight yarn. I think this works beautifully for a soft hand-spun yarn. It could also be the perfect project for a special skein. And it could also be something where you add a contrast color for the border. The shawl begins as a triangular-shaped shawl because I love that kind of shawl. I love beginning a shawl that way. And it has a nice, stretchy garter stitch edge, which is very important to me. I detest a shawl with a too tight edge. It doesn't lay beautifully, and the wingspan is compromised. It really drives me crazy. So this has a nice stretchy edge and begins with increases along the spine and yarn over crease increases at the edge of the shawl. But then deep into the third section of the shawl, there's a little series of increases that change the shape a little bit. And so rather than ending with a bandana point, as a triangular shawl often will, this design ends with a very soft scalloped edge. So it's soft and feminine, but it isn't lacy. It's a combination of stockinette stitch and garter stitch. And there are three main sections of the shawl plus a border, so that if you wanted to increase or decrease the size of the shawl, you can just increase or decrease the number of repeats that you do on any one of those sections. So I think it's nicely customizable, and the percentages help you keep track of your yarn so that you can use as much of it as you like. I think it's very gratifying to use all or almost all of a skein that you have. So that's something I kept in mind as I created the format for the pattern. The pattern is available on Ravelry, and I'm also holding a little contest for a copy of the shawl pattern and a skein of yarn to knit the shawl. The contest thread is open on the Yarns at Yinhu group, You can win a copy of Another Door Opens shawl pattern, as well as a skein of beautiful wool and mohair blend yarn from Beaver Slide Dry Goods in the gorgeous, gorgeous wild geranium colorway. I would dearly love to see this shawl knit up with some yarn for Beaver Slide Dry Goods. So I'm hopeful that you will go on over and find the contest thread. The prompt is to drop a line about something that you are looking forward to in the coming season. And I know that Yarns at Yinhu listeners come from all around the globe, so the change of the seasons means different things in different parts of the world. But I would like to know what you are looking forward to in the coming season. Drop a line and you could have a chance to win the prize. Ever-expanding skill set. In the last episode, I talked with my mom about pie and pie baking, and it has been my objective to add a recipe for pie to the Bulk Bins cook-along thread and to make that recipe available for all of you. I had initially thought of calling this pie Mile High Apple Pie, but in doing a little searching on the internet, I found that there are already recipes for Mile High Pie. And not knowing exactly the etiquette for that kind of thing, I decided just to call this pie my kind of apple pie. You can stack the apples mile high with this recipe, but I don't like to overload things too much. I think if the pie is great, it doesn't need to be mile high. It just needs to have a little vanilla ice cream or whipped cream on the side, maybe be heated up, and it will be extra special. I don't think with pie that more is necessarily better. If you are an experienced pie baker, the notion of this kind of pie will be more like an idea rather than a recipe. But I thought I would talk through a little bit about this pie and why I make it the way I do, and how to go through some of the steps. There are two kinds of apple baking that I do around this time of year. One kind is just a weeknight or a quick dessert. Cut up apples, toss them with a little bit of sugar, cinnamon, flour, put them in a shallow baking dish, and then top it with some really nice crumb, which would have butter, of course, and flour and sugar, maybe a little bit of nuts or oats sprinkled in, just put on the top, baked in the oven, essentially a no crust pie. It's very quick that way, very easy to eat, and usually there isn't much left at the end of the evening. But for more of an occasion or bringing a dessert to someone's home or for the holidays, I like to make an apple pie. And I like an apple pie where the crumb topping doesn't dissolve into the apple mixture. I like it to be its own entity. And that's when this my kind of apple pie recipe can really come in handy, because it's a double crust pie with a crumb topping on top of the second crust. I use the method that my mother and I discussed in episode 59, 2 cups of all-purpose flour, 2/3 of a cup of fat. In this case, I think half butter, half shortening could work well. I must confess, I rarely use shortening for my pies. I almost always make an all-butter crust. This kind of crust can be hard. It's harder than a crust with shortening. And of course, lard would be the ultimate fat to cut into the flour for a pie crust. But I don't have a great source for lard that I trust and I like working with, so I typically use butter. I cut the butter into the flour, and then I start adding liquid with a few tablespoons of vodka. The idea behind using vodka or some kind of alcohol, some people use vinegar, is that when the pie is baking, the alcohol burns off in the oven more quickly than water does. And so it leaves this brittle kind of crumbling texture to the crust, which can be very pleasing. So I begin adding the liquid with a few tablespoons of vodka, and then I continue with ice cold water until that dough comes together just enough to form a ball. I divide the dough, but I divide it slightly unevenly. I have a larger disc of dough for the bottom crust and then a slightly smaller one for the top crust. I put those in parchment paper, store them in the refrigerator for about a half hour while I prepare the apples. I like to use a variety of apples for an apple pie. Everything from a very firm, tart apple to an apple that's sort of moderate in terms of sweetness and crispness, to a few apples that are really more for eating out of hand than for baking. I core and peel and slice all of these apples, and I keep the types separate in separate bowls as I do this. This can take a bit of time, so I use some lemon juice to keep any browning from happening. And when everything has been cored, peeled, and sliced, I put a big, heavy-bottomed pot on my burner, melt a little bit of butter, and then I start gently, gently cooking down the apples just a bit. And I begin with the firmest, tartest apples first. So I put those into the pot. Sometimes I need to add a little bit of water to get this process going. And they're just gently cooking. The objective here is not to make applesauce. It's just to start the cooking process on the apples. I let those firm apples cook for just a bit, and then I add the next firm, and so on until I turn the heat off of the burner. And then I add the very softest, sweetest apples last. I just toss everything in this heavy-bottomed pot to distribute the types of apples evenly among themselves. And I add some flour, a bit of sugar, and some baking spices at this point, and I let them warm up. Lately, I've been adding an Indian spice mix, garam masala, to my apple pie filling. There are probably as many different kinds of garam masala as there are cooks who make Indian cuisine. It's always a different spice blend, but in general, it has the warming fall spices of cinnamon, allspice, clove, nutmeg, ginger, sometimes some black pepper as well. I think it makes a little bit of an exotic flavor for an apple pie. If you're more traditional, you could just go with cinnamon, maybe a bit of nutmeg. So I toss that together and I let that cool while I remove the dough from the refrigerator and roll it out. First, I roll out the bottom crust, put it into the pie plate. Then I add the apple mixture very carefully. And this cooking down process allows you to put quite a bit of apples in your pie. I think more than if you were just slicing them up and putting them in fresh. They start to cook down, and so they fill the pie plate very thoroughly, in a very dense manner. So I think you could easily fit 10 or 12 medium-sized apples into this pie without it being a gigantic mile-high pie. Then I roll out the second top crust. I roll it out very, very thin. I put it over the top and trim the dough, crimp the edges in a way that pleases me. I tend to use a very traditional crimp. I cut a few very large slices in the top crust so that steam can escape while the pie is cooking. And sometimes I drizzle a little bit of honey or maple syrup, or I brush that top crust with a little bit of butter, melted butter. And then I add all of the crumb topping. My crumb topping contains usually between a third of a cup to a half of a cup each of brown sugar, flour, and butter. And then I like to add some chopped walnuts, some flaked coconut, sometimes a handful of oats to that mixture. So it's really nice and crumbly. So I put that crumb mixture on the top of the pie and then I bake it. I don't like to go much beyond a 375 degree oven for my apple pie. It's quite dense, so it can take a long time to cook. And as my mom mentioned in the previous episode, it's very important to make sure that your pie is bubbling, not just along the crust outside edge, but in the center of the pie. That's how you know it's done. This can be a little bit tricky with this pie because you have a second crust and then you have a crumb on top. But you can see in the center of the pie when it's bubbling under there. And that's when you remove the pie from the oven and let it cool. I am very interested in your recipes for pie, your favorite kinds of pie for this time of year, and anything else, maybe not baking pies, but anything else you might be doing with flour for the Bulk Bins Cook Along this month. In response to some folks who posted on the Bulk Bins Cook Along thread, I have included my Aunt Marie's recipe for peach pie. It's typed up there, and I think I posted it in a few different places. So I hope you will try that out. It works well with frozen peaches. In fact, even in peak peach season, where there are lots of fresh peaches available, my mother, when she makes this pie, tends to use a half and half mixture of fresh and frozen peaches. Putting frozen fruit into the pie keeps it from cooking quite so quickly and keeps it from getting overcooked and mushy. So that can be a good technique to use with a soft flesh fruit like peaches are. If you try the pie, let me know. I'd like to know how yours turns out. A little bit of learning. This segment of A Little Bit of Learning concerns a question about blind baking a pie crust that comes from Kay Connors, Kathleen. She posted it on the Ravelry thread, and in listening to my conversation with my mom about baking pies, I did notice that we didn't devote too much time to the idea of blind baking a crust. And this is something that can be a bit intimidating, and I thought it deserved a little bit more attention. So Kathleen, here you go. The term blind baking refers to completely or partially baking a crust in a pie plate without any filling in the pie. So it's just the pie plate and the crust. You would do this if you have a filling that isn't going to be cooked at all, or a filling that might compromise that bottom crust by getting it too soggy before it had a chance to bake. In which case, blind baking is a perfect application. So I'm going to use the example of banana cream pie. With banana cream pie, there are sliced bananas, which should be fresh. They shouldn't be cooking under a layer of custard. And so what you do for a banana cream pie is you completely blind bake a crust. and then you slice your bananas, put them on the bottom, and then you add some cooled custard that you've cooked, preferably cooked on a stovetop, although you might have used some kind of instant pudding. And then you put a layer of whipped cream over that and you chill the pie. You keep it cold. Another example, maybe for partially baking a pie, could be something like a pecan pie, which has a very sugary liquid filling. And sometimes it's nice to set the crust a little bit before you add that filling to the pie. In this case, it would be partially baked because I need that filling to cook in the oven. It's not something that can be consumed without cooking. And so I would put the pie crust in the pie plate, bake it for maybe 10-15 minutes, pull it out, add my filling, and then return it to the oven so that the pecan pie can cook all of the way. The intimidating factor for blind baking a crust is that the chemistry of pie baking is such that those first 10 or 15 minutes in the oven, when all of the butter softens, it's like the crust wants to retake its liquid form, and the entire edge of the pie crust can sink to the bottom of the pie plate if you're not careful. This is devastating. You can't fix it. You have to start all over. So there are a couple of things you can do in order to ensure that your pie crust with no filling in it is going to stay in place the same way it would if you had a filling in it. One of the things my mother suggested in the last episode is that when you put your crust, your dough, into the pie plate, you use a fork to prick it very thoroughly all around the pie. So the whole bottom of the pie plate, prick, 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 prick. The edges of the pie plate, many fork pricks there. And also that corner where the bottom meets the sides, prick it very carefully there. That helps prevent that sagging that can occur. I think it's also important to consider the kind of pie plate that you're using. There are many fancy decorative kinds of pie plates. They may not be the best for blind baking applications. I like a very traditional Pyrex pie plate with a lip, and when I crimp my crust, I make sure that that crimp is sitting on the lip so that the crimped crust itself can help hold the pie in its plate. My mom suggested putting an aluminum pie plate inside the pie dish. That can help the crust hold its shape. I like to use a piece of parchment paper inside the pie plate, and then I have a container of beans that I use only for this purpose. I would never cook these beans. I just reuse them over and over like a weight for inside of my pie shell. So I pour those beans into the parchment paper, I blind bake the crust that way, and then I can easily remove them when I take the pie crust out of the oven. There are also little clay beads and other sorts of things that you can purchase as weights for blind baking a pie crust. When you blind bake a pie crust and you do it successfully, it really is a cause for triumph. So I hope you give it a try, and I hope this information has been helpful. Gratitude Journal. This episode would not be complete if I didn't mention my deep gratitude for Mary Beth, whose Ravelry name is Out of This World, and who has graciously provided me with support, cheerleading, technical advice, and so much more through the process of writing my first shawl pattern. unsolicited, Mary Beth offered to be a test knitter for the pattern. And this was very early on in the process, before I was really even ready to turn over a written pattern. I still had a lot of work to do on the shawl, and Mary Beth sent me photos of yarn that she was considering using, and she said, "Oh, I think I've decided on this one." And I said, "Okay." And then a few days later, she sent me another photograph, and she's like, nope, this is the one." I had said very little to her about my idea for the shawl and where the idea came from. And she sent me a photograph of Tosh Merino Light in the Candlewick colorway that is the precise golden color of the ginkgo leaves when they fall. I was struck speechless. I couldn't believe she had captured the spirit and the essence of my inspiration for the shawl with her choice of yarn. Throughout her knitting process, Mary Beth kept great notes. We went back and forth on some of the aspects of the pattern, and she knit such a beautiful shawl. She put some pictures up on Ravelry. It's just stunning. And I hope you will take a look at it and congratulate her on her beautiful, beautiful knitting. Mary Beth titled her project Golden Opportunity. I think that is such a beautiful title, and it puts me in mind of all of the golden and gorgeous opportunities that I've had to meet people and connect with skilled craftspeople, people who care about the environment and doing things with their hands, people who care about giving and generosity. I think that knitting and fiber arts in general has been a golden opportunity for me. Definitely another door has opened as a result of my learning to do crafts in the fiber arts. And it just reminds me of the overwhelming feelings of gratitude that I have this week.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yanhu group on Ravelry. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Nature's a bouquet you hide till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a silly nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.